Chapter 8. Had entered into a conspiracy with Miss Griffin to expose us, and that we should all be put into white sheets, and exhibited in the center aisle. But, so westerly if I may be allowed the expression as opposite to eastern associations was Miss Griffin's sense of rectitude, that she merely suspected apples, and we were saved. I have called the Seraglio, United. Upon the question, solely, whether the commander of the faithful durst exercise a right of kissing in that sanctuary of the palace, were its peerless inmates divided. Zobeid asserted a counter right in the favorite to scratch, and the fair Circassian put her face, for refuge, into a green baize bag, originally designed for books. On the other hand, a young antelope of transcendent beauty from the fruitful plains of Camden Town, whence she had been brought, by traders, in the half-yearly caravan that crossed the intermediate desert after the holidays, held more liberal opinions, but stipulated for limiting the benefit of them to that dog, and son of a dog, the Grand Vizier who had no rights, and was not in question. At length, the difficulty was compromised by the installation of a very youthful slave as deputy. She, raised upon a stool, officially received upon her cheeks the salutes intended by the gracious Heron for other sultanas, and was privately rewarded from the coffers of the ladies of the harem. And now it was, at the full height of enjoyment of my bliss, that I became heavily troubled. I began to think of my mother, and what she would say to my taking home at midsummer 8 of the most beautiful of the daughters of men, but all unexpected. I thought of the number of bets we made up at our house, of my father's income, and of the baker, and my despondency redoubled. The Seraglio and malicious vizier, divining the cause of their lord's unhappiness, did their utmost to augment it. They professed unbounded fidelity, and declared that they would live and die with him. Reduced to the utmost wretchedness by these protestations of attachment, I lay awake for hours at a time, ruminating on my frightful lot. In my despair, I think I might have taken an early opportunity of falling on my knees before Miss Griffin, avowing my resemblance to Solomon, and praying to be dealt with according to the outraged laws of my country, if an unthought of means of escape had not opened before me. One day, we were out walking, two, and two on which occasion the vizier had his usual instructions, to take note of the boy at the turnpike, and if he profanely gazed, which he always did, at the beauties of the harem, to have him bowstring in the course of the night, and it happened that our hearts were veiled in gloom. An unaccountable action on the part of the antelope had plunged the state into disgrace. That charmer, on the representation that the previous day was her birthday, and that vast treasures had been sent in a hamper for its celebration, both baseless assertions, had secretly but most pressingly invited 35 neighboring princes and princesses to a ball and supper, with a special stipulation that they were not to be fetched till 12. This wandering of the antelope's fancy led to the surprising arrival at Miss Griffin's door, in divers equipages, and under various escorts, of a great company in full dress, who were deposited on the top step in a flush of high expectancy, and who were dismissed in tears. At the beginning of the double knocks attendant on these ceremonies, the antelope had retired to a back attic, and bolted herself in. And at every new arrival, Miss Griffin had gone, so much more and more distracted, that at last she had been seen to tear her front. Ultimate capitulation on the part of the offender had been followed by solitude in the linen closet, bread and water and a lecture to all, of vindictive length, in which Miss Griffin had used expressions. Firstly, I believe you all of you knew of it. Secondly, every one of you is as wicked as another. Thirdly, a pack of little wretches. Under these circumstances, we were walking drearily along, and I especially, with my Musulman responsibilities heavy on me, was in a very low state of mind, when a strange man accosted Miss Griffin, and, after walking on at her side for a little while and talking with her, looked at me. supposing him to be a minion of the law, and that my hour was come, I instantly ran away, with the general purpose of making for Egypt. The whole seraglio cried out, when they saw me making off as fast as my legs would carry me. I had an impression that the first turning on the left, and round by the public house, would be the shortest way to the pyramids. Miss Griffin screamed after me, the faithless vizier ran after me, and the boy at the turnpike dodged me into a corner, like a sheep, and cut me off. Nobody scolded me when I was taken and brought back. Miss Griffin only said, with a stunning gentleness, "This was very curious. Why had I run away, when the gentleman looked at me? If I had had any breath to answer with, I dare say I should have made no answer. Having no breath, I certainly made none." Miss Griffin and the strange man took me between them, and walked me back to the palace in a sort of state, but not at all, as I couldn't help feeling, with astonishment, in culprit state. When we got there, we went into a room by ourselves, and Miss Griffin called in to her assistance, Mezr, chief of the dusky guards of the harem. Mezr, on being whispered to, began to shed tears. "Bless you, my precious," said that officer, turning to me, "your pa's took bitter bad." I asked, with a fluttered heart, "Is he very ill?" "Lord temper the wind to you, my lamb," said the good Mezr, kneeling down, that I might have a comforting shoulder for my head to rest on, "your pa's dead." Harun al-Rashid took to flight at the words. The seraglio vanished. From that moment, I never again saw one of the eight of the fairest of the daughters of men. I was taken home, and there was death at home as well as death, and we had a sale there. My own little bed was so superciliously looked upon by a power unknown to me, hazily called the trade, that a brass coal scuttle, a roasting jack, and a birdcage were obliged to be put into it to make a lot of it, and then it went for a song. So I heard mentioned, and I wondered what song, and thought what a dismal song it must have been to sing. Then, I was sent to a great, cold, bare school of big boys, where everything to eat and wear was thick and clumpy, without being enough, where everybody, largo and small, was cruel, where the boys knew all about the sale, before I got there, and asked me what I had fetched, and who had bought me, and hooted at me, "Going, going, gone." I never whispered in that wretched place that I had been Aaron, or had had a seraglio. For, I knew that, if I mentioned my reverses, I should be so worried, that I should have to drown myself in the muddy pond near the playground, which looked like a beer. Ah me, ah me. No other ghost has haunted the boys' room, my friends, since I have occupied it, than the ghost of my own childhood, the ghost of my own innocence, the ghost of my own airy belief. Many a time have I pursued the phantom. Never with this man's stride of mine to come up with it, never with these man's hands of mine to touch it, never more to this man's heart of mine to hold it in its purity. And here you see me working out, as cheerfully and thankfully as I may, my doom of shaving in the glass a constant change of customers, and of lying down and rising up with the skeleton allotted to me for my mortal companion. The trial for murder. I have always noticed a prevalent want of courage, even among persons of superior intelligence and culture, as to imparting their own psychological experiences, when those have been of a strange sort. Almost all men are afraid that what they could relate in such wise would find no parallel or response in a listener's internal life, and might be suspected or laughed at. A truthful traveler, who should have seen some extraordinary creature in the likeness of a sea serpent, would have no fear of mentioning it. But the same traveler, having had some singular presentiment, impulse, vagary of thought, vision so-called, dream, or other remarkable mental impression, would hesitate considerably before he would own to it. To this reticence I attribute much of the obscurity in which such subjects are involved. We do not habitually communicate our experiences of these subjective things as we do our experiences of objective creation. The consequence is that the general stock of experience in this regard appears exceptional, and really is so, in respect of being miserably imperfect. In what I am going to relate, I have no intention of setting up, opposing, or supporting any theory whatever. I know the history of the bookseller of Berlin. I have studied the case of the wife of a late astronomer royal as related by Sir David Brewster, and I have followed the minute's details of a much more remarkable case of spectral illusion occurring within my private circle of friends. It may be necessary to state, as to this last, that the sufferer, a lady, was in no degree, however distant, related to me. A mistaken assumption on that head might suggest an explanation of a part of my own case, but only a part, which would be wholly without foundation. It cannot be referred to my inheritance of any developed peculiarity, nor had I ever before any at all similar experience, nor have I ever had any at all similar experience since. It does not signify how many years ago, or how few, a certain murder was committed in England, which attracted great attention. We hear more than enough of murderers as they rise in succession to their atrocious eminence, and I would bury the memory of this particular brute, if I could, as his body was buried, in Newgate Jail. I purposely abstain from giving any direct clue to the criminal's individuality. When the murder was first discovered, no suspicion fell, or I ought rather to say, for I cannot be too precise in my facts, it was nowhere publicly hinted that any suspicion fell on the man who was afterwards brought to trial. As no reference was at that time made to him in the newspapers, it is obviously impossible that any description of him can at that time have been given in the newspapers. It is essential that this fact be remembered. Unfolding at breakfast my morning paper, containing the account of that first discovery, I found it to be deeply interesting, and I read it with close attention. I read it twice, if not three times. The discovery had been made in a bedroom, and, when I laid down the paper, I was aware of a flash rush flow I do not know what to call it, no word I can find is satisfactorily descriptive, in which I seemed to see that bedroom passing through my room, like a picture impossibly painted on a running river. Though almost instantaneous in its passing, it was perfectly clear, so clear that I distinctly, and with a sense of relief, observed the absence of the dead body from the bed. It was in no romantic place that I had this curious sensation, but in chambers in Piccadilly, very near to the corner of St. James Street. It was entirely new to me. I was in my easy chair at the moment, and the sensation was accompanied with a peculiar shiver which started the chair from its position. But it is to be noted that the chair ran easily on casters. I went to one of the windows, there are two in the room, and the room is on the second floor, to refresh my eyes with the moving objects down in Piccadilly. It was a bright autumn morning, and the street was sparkling and cheerful. The wind was high. As I looked out, it brought down from the park a quantity of fallen leaves, which a gust took, and whirled into a spiral pillar. As the pillar fell, and the leaves dispersed, I saw two men on the opposite side of the way, going from west to east. They were one behind the other. The foremost man often looked back over his shoulder. The second man followed him, at a distance of some 30 paces, with his right hand menacingly raised. First, the singularity and steadiness of this threatening gesture in so public a thoroughfare attracted my attention. And next, the more remarkable circumstance, that nobody heeded it. Both men threaded their way among the other passengers with a smoothness hardly consistent even with the action of walking on a pavement, and no single creature, that I could see, gave them place, touched them, or looked after them. In passing before my windows, they both stared up at me. I saw their two faces very distinctly, and I knew that I could recognize them anywhere. Not that I had consciously noticed anything very remarkable in either face, except that the man who went first had an unusually lowering appearance, and that the face of the man who followed him was of the color of impure wax. I am a bachelor, and my valet and his wife constitute my whole establishment. My occupation is in a certain branch bank, and I wish that my duties as head of a department were as light as they are popularly supposed to be. They kept me in town that autumn when I stood in need of change. I was not ill, but I was not well. My reader is to make the most that can be reasonably made of my feeling jaded, having a depressing sense upon me of a monotonous life, and being slightly dyspeptic. I am assured by my renowned doctor that my real state of health at that time justifies no stronger description, and I quote his own from his written answer to my request for it. As the circumstances of the murder, gradually unraveling, took stronger and stronger possession of the public mind, I kept them away from mine, by knowing as little about them as was possible in the midst of the universal excitement. But I knew that a verdict of willful murder had been found against the suspected murderer, and that he had been committed to Newgate for trial. I also knew that his trial had been postponed over one sessions of the Central Criminal Court, on the ground of general prejudice and want of time for the preparation of the defense. I may further have known, but I believe I did not, when, or about when, the sessions to which his trial stood postponed would come on. My sitting room, bedroom, and dressing room are all on one floor. With the last there is no communication, but through the bedroom. True, there is a door in it, once communicating with the staircase, but a part of the fitting of my bath has been and had then been for some years fixed across it. At the same period, and as a part of the same arrangement, the door had been nailed up and canvased over. I was standing in my bedroom late one night, giving some directions to my servant, before he went to bed. My face was towards the only available door of communication with the dressing room, and it was closed. My servant's back was towards that door. While I was speaking to him, I saw it open, and a man look in, who very earnestly and mysteriously beckoned to me. That man was the man who had gone second of the two along Piccadilly, and whose face was of the color of impure wax. The figure, having beckoned, drew back, and closed the door. With no longer pause than was made by my crossing the bedroom, I opened the dressing room door, and looked in. I had a lighted candle already in my hand. I felt no inward expectation of seeing the figure in the dressing room, and I did not see it there. Conscious that my servant stood amazed, I turned round to him, and said, "Derek, could you believe that in my cool senses I fancied I saw a—" As I there laid my hand upon his breast, with a sudden start he trembled violently, and said, "Oh Lord, yes, sir. A dead man beckoning." Now I do not believe that this John Derrick, my trusty and attached servant for more than 20 years, had any impression whatever of having seen any such figure, until I touched him. The change in him was so startling, when I touched him, that I fully believe he derived his impression in some occult manner from me at that instant. I bade John Derrick bring some brandy, and I gave him a dram, and was glad to take one myself. Of what had preceded that night's phenomenon, I told him not a single word. Reflecting on it, I was absolutely certain that I had never seen that face before, except on the one occasion in Piccadilly. Comparing its expression when beckoning at the door with its expression when it had stared up at me as I stood at my window, I came to the conclusion that on the Gutenberg edition, end of chapter.